It's Lars Larson. Thanks for listening to my podcast and for listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. On the Lars Larson Show, which is, he's a conservative talk radio host.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
Lars. If you have evidence of wrongdoing by any member of the Trump campaign, present it to the damn grand jury.
Here's Lars Larson.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
On FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Monday on the Radio Northwest Network, back from Washington, D.C. last week. And, of course, it always changes your perspective when you get on an Alaska Airlines flight in our nation's capital and you go back to take your seat in coach. And you notice that the three Democrats on the flight are all sitting up in first class, all with tickets paid for by the taxpayers done. But that's just a matter of perspective. Also had an interesting conversation that I'll relate to you about Pramila Jayapal, member of Congress, who represents part of the Seattle area. And that was actually a relatively pleasant conversation. And I invited her to come on the show one of these days. Maybe we can talk impeachment. And yes, developments on the impeachment front are coming fast and furious. Yes, pun intended. So, yeah, that's on the top of today's agenda. But I'll get to it a bit later in this hour. I thought I'd start first with our Twitter poll and also corrupt Kate Brown, who has a couple of crazy things going on this week. Our Twitter poll, though, has to do with a push that is being made by state government in both Oregon and Washington. And here's what they're saying. We want to adopt a six-month moratorium on the sale of all vaping products. Now, we've talked about vaping quite a bit, but about this specific policy, unless they're just trying to push people to cigarettes, I don't see what the bottom line of this is. It doesn't make any sense. I don't vape. I don't do ads for vaping companies, so I don't have a dog in the fight. I also don't smoke cigarettes. But I don't have a problem with those people who choose to use America's longest-running commercial product. Do you know for the first 100 years that Europeans were on the North American continent, long before it became the United States of America, the biggest single export from North America to Europe for 100 years was tobacco? Now, no matter what your attitude about tobacco is, those of you who believe in freedom and liberty should say if it's a legal product, you should be able to use it. So some people choose to smoke cigarettes. Lately, there are people who choose to vape. As I said, I'm not one of them. But here's the development now. Because they've had a specific problem with vaping, and especially with people using both marijuana or THC oil products and vaping, and especially using those kind of products that aren't made on the standard marketplace, they're off the black market, that seem to have created some real health problems. A total of about 8 deaths nationwide, about 500 people who have gone to the hospital. And it seems to be almost or exclusively related to THC products. But you see, the Oregon Health Authority, and now the health authorities in Washington State, are planning to ban all vaping products, both the nicotine vaping products and the THC products. I think what they're seeing is an opportunity. They see this as an opportunity to get rid of vaping altogether. Now, I don't see any reason to do that. Frankly, I think that vaping is a great way for people who currently smoke cigarettes to move to vaping and reduce the health, the deleterious health effects by about 95%. And what really doesn't make sense to me is most of the folks in state government, you know, Kate Brown, Jay Inslee, the knuckleheads in the legislatures in Olympia and Salem, they don't seem to think beyond the first step. I know we'll ban vaping products for 6 months in both Oregon and Washington. That is what they're proposing to do now. Have you thought? You're not playing checkers here. You're playing chess. Have you thought to what happens on the second move? On the second move, everybody who currently vapes is going to do one of two things. Number one, they're going to find their vaping products elsewhere, and they are available online. And unless the governments of Oregon and Washington plan to say you can't buy it through Amazon, All they're going to do is shift everybody's vaping purchases to online retailers and destroy a lot of local retailers. If that's their goal, I know the Democrats are always they're always very good at destroying jobs. In fact, that's another subject I'll get to a bit later. But you'll either push people to find other sources for their vaping products. That's one possibility. The second possibility is that everybody who currently vapes will find themselves unable to buy the product, and they will switch back to cigarettes. Now, there is a third possibility, but I really don't think it's realistic. Since I've never smoked, I can't speak from personal experience, but my understanding is that quitting cigarettes, based on what I've heard from my friends, from family members, is one of the toughest addictions of all to break. Even when they've made it illegal for you to smoke virtually everywhere. Can't smoke in a public building. Can't smoke in a private building. You can only smoke in your house. And for now, we'll let you smoke in your car, but we may be banning that as well. You can't smoke within 10 or 25 feet of a window or a doorway. They have made it exceedingly hard, and even still, people have a tough time kicking the habit even when they want to. If the state government says, you're going to quit that nicotine habit, whether it's from vaping or cigarettes, in this case, in vaping, we're simply going to stop selling the product anywhere in Oregon or Washington. As I said, the two likely outcomes I can see is you'll find the vaping products elsewhere by going into Amazon or some other buying source, or you will switch from vaping to cigarettes, which is Kate Brown and Jay Inslee in the health departments of both states saying, we'd like you to go to the kind of nicotine delivery that is much more dangerous for you, right? If you go from cigarettes to vaping, you reduce the health effects by about 95%. Go back the other direction, you're increasing it by what, 10,000%, the damage that you're doing? Is that what they want to do? Because I don't see people saying, oh, you want me to quit vaping? Sure, no problem. Easy to do. If you've asked anybody who smokes cigarettes, they'll tell you, oh, it's easy to quit. I've quit hundreds of times. Yeah. The joke is that it is really hard to quit. So I'm asking in the Twitter poll, won't this new proposed policy, they haven't done it yet, but it sounds like they're on the way, just push vapers to cigarettes? And I would say, yes, that's exactly what it's going to do. So the official policy of the states of Oregon and Washington in pushing this is to take people from a less damaging form of nicotine delivery to a tremendously more damaging form. So that's on the agenda as well. And I want to spend just a moment on the death penalty. Yesterday was the effective date, and I still want you to understand the duplicity that went on here. The people of Oregon chose the death penalty. If it were put to a vote today, I know to a fair certainty they would choose the death penalty again. That's why Kate Brown, the governor of Oregon, will not allow it to go to a public vote. So instead, this past summer, the Oregon legislature said, we can't get away with rescinding the death penalty and revoking it altogether. So we will make a law that says you only can apply the death penalty in such rare circumstances that we've done all but revoke the death penalty. That way, by stopping just short of getting rid of it altogether, they can say, now we don't have to put it to a vote of the people. And then it was pointed out that they had lied about the law. They said it wouldn't be retroactive. It is. It is going to give greater freedoms to 28 of the 29 people currently on death row. And then Kate Brown reluctantly, and only after weeks of dead stone silence on the subject, Kate Brown said, okay, we'll have a special session and we'll fix the law. And they waited a few weeks. It basically, it's like the you know, when the shot clock is running at the end of a ball game and one guy just stands there and dribbles the ball on an NBA team because all he's doing is running out the clock. She ran out the clock and then said, oh gosh, it's just so expensive. We can't afford to have a one-day special session to fix this law. So now she is spitting in the face of voters. And she's especially spitting in the face of all those families who have lost loved ones to murderers who they were told were going to be executed. And now Kate Brown has freed them from execution. There is perhaps one person on death row who still is up for the death penalty. The rest of them will effectively be removed from death row. And I find that highly offensive. If the voters had done it, I would accept the outcome, just as I have with other votes that I didn't like. But this is more of this nonsense where elected officials have now decided what the public says and what the voters say does not matter. And we don't give a damn what you're telling us. If they wanted to have a vote, they could easily have a vote. The voters have, in fact, called this show and said, why don't we have a vote on this? I said, because Kate Brown knows what the outcome of the vote would be. The outcome would be she'd lose. And then you'd have a reinvigorated death penalty, freshly reinstated by the voters. And then she'd have no excuse for not carrying out those death sentences. She can't afford that because she has substituted her own personal political moral choice for the choice of the voters of the state. You're spitting in the face of voters. You're spitting in the face of the families who've lost somebody to a convicted killer who is supposed to face execution. As of yesterday, those convicted killers are now going to get new freedoms. We've got all of that on the agenda. Oh, and I do want to remind you in a moment about something that happened long time ago. An illegal alien who was getting a ride in a police car. Not because he was accused of a crime, just the police officer was doing something nice for this illegal alien, who also was drunk. And the illegal alien repaid him because he'd managed to hide a .38. And he shot Brad Clodfelter in the back of the head twice and executed him, murdered him. And he was, in fact, an illegal alien. Somebody tell me that illegal aliens are not a problem in this society. Our Twitter poll, you'll find at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, LarsLarson.com on the web. Won't this new policy on vaping simply push vapers to cigarettes? In Friday's poll, should cities make calling somebody an illegal alien illegal, as New York City now does? 95% of you said no, as I did as well. Only 5% of you said yes. Glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. We're glad always to take your calls. You know that naysayers go to the head of the line on this program, unlike every other. You call me up at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Coming up in a moment, we'll talk about the Northwest nonsense, and I'll talk just a bit about the impeachment talk on Capitol Hill. And Nancy Pelosi says it doesn't matter if it costs the Democrats the House of Representatives. We'll get to that in the nonsense and your calls and emails. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
Makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Democrat House Speaker Nancy Pelosi promises an impeachment vote by Thanksgiving. Now, Pelosi admits it may cost her party its majority on Capitol Hill in the House. And she says that's okay. In fact, I'll play the soundbite for you later. She literally was asked, isn't this likely to cost you your majority in the House? She said yes, and that's okay. A so-called whistleblower says President Trump made an illicit deal with the new president of Ukraine. We can talk about that deal. I think the whole complaint is full of hogwash. The only whistle I hear is the winds of truth whistling through the holes in the whistleblower's complaint. First, this unnamed whistleblower admits he has a political bias against President Trump. Second, he admits he has zero firsthand knowledge to back up his complaint. And by the way, the CIA had always required, for decades it had required, that if you're a whistleblower, you have to have firsthand knowledge of the thing that you are blowing a whistle on. Well, they changed those rules in August, just a couple of weeks before this complaint was filed. Strange, and it seems very convenient. Third, the unnamed whistleblower, so-called, alleges that President Trump spent most of the phone call to the Ukrainian president talking about Joe Biden and Joe Biden's corrupt son named Hunter. A transcript of the call shows that Biden's name came up exactly once. It was not the bulk of the call. A Ukrainian natural gas company put Hunter Biden on its board of directors at $50,000 a month. In some years, he made more than $1 million from that board position. He made millions over the course of about 5 years, but a prosecutor in Ukraine was investigating because he suspected the natural gas company was a money laundering operation. prosecution would have been very bad news for Hunter and for his daddy, Vice President Joe Biden. So Biden got the prosecutor fired, and then he bragged about getting him fired on camera. He said he had threatened to withhold $1 billion in loan guarantees from the United States if the prosecutor wasn't fired, and sure enough, Ukraine fired the prosecutor. That's what President Trump asked about, and Democrats want him impeached for trying to find out what quid pro Joe Biden was up to. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Les Schwab Tire Centers. Doing the right thing matters.
Well, this is amazing. I mentioned the death penalty law, the revocation of the death penalty without asking the voters about it. This is a certainly much less important rule, but it starts tomorrow, and I'm interested to see how it works out. I actually might have a dog in the fight here. Starting tomorrow, Portlanders will have to ask for plastics, things like straws, utensils, and packaged condiments like soy sauce or coffee creamer. The city's new plastics policy means that nearly all food purveyors, including food carts, hotels, caterers, and bars, get this, could face a $500 fine for automatically providing disposable plastic utensils to customers. So if the customer doesn't ask for the plastic fork and you give him or her the plastic fork without the request from the customer, a $500 fine, that's absolute insanity. And it reminds me, every day because I'm trying to watch what I eat, I've been eating a chicken salad. I usually buy it at the Starbucks store in the bottom of our building. You know, those folks know me well enough. They know that I'm going to eat egg white egg bites for breakfast. Those are, you know, no bread and all that stuff. And that I'm going to get a salad. And they know I always ask for a plastic fork. That means tomorrow morning, if I walk into Starbucks and I don't ask them for a plastic fork and they hand me a plastic fork without having had the request first, they could face a $500 fine. Can you believe this? We let the homeless use the sidewalks as a toilet, but a store is going to get whacked with a $500 fine for giving me a plastic fork that I didn't ask for. Today's best email, but you can send more to talk@LarsLarson.com from the mechanical engineer Pat McKenzie, who says, Lars, the people I talk to see the impeachment effort as a continuation of the attempt to overturn the election of a duly elected president. I don't see how you could see it any other way. The result will be the elimination of Joe Biden because of his corruption. Have you noticed that whenever Biden is asked a challenging question, he starts shaking? It'll be the phony warren against our very successful president. The people will decide. The so-called news media can sway about 5 to 10% with their propaganda. I believe that Trump will win easily, he writes. The Midwest will be solidly behind Trump. The South, solidly behind Trump. My guess is he'll win two or three more states than he won last time. It'll be a red wave across the country, up to the Northeast and the West Coast. I look forward to seeing the so-called journalists on CNN crying on election night. That will be very entertaining, signed Pat McKenzie. Glad to have you with me on a Monday. Glad to be back from Washington, D.C. You don't want to stay too long in the swamp. It can be catching. Glad to get your calls, too. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Miss something on The Lars Larson Show? Check out posted interviews and podcasts at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. We're back in our home studio today after that trip to Washington, D.C. and the trip home on the airplane. Democrat members of Congress in first class on Alaska and the rest of us in coach class. I thought I'd check in with Mike Cross, who is running one of two complimentary recall campaigns against the governor of Oregon, Kate Brown, who richly deserves to be recalled for any number of solid reasons, a whole lot more solid than the high crimes and misdemeanors the Democrats seem to think that the president has committed because they haven't really outlined that yet. Mike Cross joins me now. Hey, Mike, are you there?
I'm there, Lars. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Now, tomorrow marks, if I understand the calendar right, 2 weeks until the drop-dead date for turning in all the signatures to either get the Kate Brown recall on the ballot or not. Now, up till now, I have not been asking the two campaigns to give me specific numbers. But we are 2 weeks out, as I understand the GOP effort, which is complementary to yours. It's not the same effort. It's a different effort, but it's the two campaigns have been working somewhat together. How many signatures do you have right now?
Well, you know, I don't have the exact number.
Now, come on, then give me a ballpark. Where are you, right? Where do you stand?
About 200,000.
About 200,000, and you need 280, right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct.
So do you think in the next 2 weeks you can get that last 80,000 signatures?
Well, here's the thing that I'm surprised about, Lars, is that there's still so many people out there that don't know there's a recall going on. I mean, it just blows my mind. And these are people that would absolutely sign this petition if they knew it was there. And that is so frustrating. And the other issue that we've been having is, you know, our logging, you know, companies, things like that. I mean, that adamantly oppose the carbon tax and gross receipts and things like that. And they honestly, they've not stepped up to the plate. So we don't have the dollars to promote this cause like it should have been done in the first place.
Well, I've given both of the recall campaigns all the time I have to offer. Obviously, and I appreciate that. But the mainstream TV networks have had no interest in trying to push this out to
Funny
people
thing about that, huh?
Well, it is. It fits exactly with what I think. They would say, well, it's not our job to tell people. Well, they certainly make it their job to tell folks about a whole bunch of other things that are less important than whether or not the governor should be recalled. But if you fall short, if you don't get those, and you really need more than 80,000, you need at least 100,000 signatures in the next 2 weeks, don't you?
I would say that we need about 150,000 more signatures. There is a way that we can do that, but it's going to take some marketing dollars to do that. And there's two different avenues that I know of that we could do that, but it's going to take some donations.
How many people do you think out there right now are holding on to a petition sheet with a signature, a couple of signatures, who might bring them in the next 2 weeks? Because that's after the 14th of October, you're out of luck.
Well, exactly. And I, you know, it's tough to say because it's like, you know, you go out hunting in the woods, you don't know how many deer are in the valley. You know what I mean? So yeah. It's just, and the thing is I get the feeling that there's 150,000 signatures out there. They just need to be sent in, but I can't prove it. I don't know it for sure. I can tell you that the amount that we've paid, this is just what I know of, in printing costs, is sufficient to get 800,000 signatures.
So you've already printed up enough petitions to be able to gather 800,000 signatures, but you only have 200 in hand.
And that's just what I know of, because I know a number of people have done printing on their own. You know how it works.
Sure.
But and I know of only one county captain that he had some of those. Maybe about enough for 50 or 100,000 signatures. And then he made those available to people that wanted the blanks, the blank forms. But, you know, so I have to think that there's not a lot of blank petitions sitting around that they're actually filled in. And for whatever reason, they're not turning them in. I know that over the last weekend, we got some signatures in that were almost, they're about two and a half months old. And it's like, why on earth would those be still sitting in somebody's hands? I have no idea.
I think sometimes people get excited about a campaign. They jump in, they print a signature sheet, they put the signatures on it, and then for whatever reason, the rest of life, which, you know, for most people is a full-time occupation. You've got sleep,
sure.
You've got work, you've got family, you've got responsibilities, and they think, I will get that in there one of these days. Well, in the next 2 weeks, if it doesn't, listen, let me ask you, about the GOP effort, we've been trying to get a hold of Bill Currier all day
sure.
today, because I said when we get back from D.C., we're 2 weeks away from the deadline. I want to know where we stand. Is his effort in any better shape than yours?
From what I know, no, unfortunately not. You know, and the thing that people have to realize is, It could doom this campaign, which otherwise would have been successful if people sit on these signatures too long. Because, as you know, we have to do a verification process. Duplicates will invalidate a lot of other signatures. I actually ran into a guy at a gun store, and he was kind of proud of the fact I signed the thing three times. I'm like, do you realize what you just did? And it's like, you know, because, as you know, they take a 10% sample, and then for every duplicate, you know, they basically have to extrapolate from there and then delete.
And they do. And it means that one set of duplicate signatures is going to be multiplied by 10. And if you have 100 duplicate signatures and you multiply by 10, it takes a lot of signatures off. So even if you were at, it's 280 and change, isn't it?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, 280,050. So we need time to process these and delete duplicates from people that, I don't know.
Which I understand the GOP effort has been doing as they go. They've been trying to clean them up as they go, keeping a list on a computer of everyone who has signed and then eliminating the duplicates as they can. So here's the question that I need to have answered. Does this say that Oregon is satisfied with the leadership of Kate Brown if you can't even get the signatures necessary to put the recall on the ballot?
Well, and that's a scary thing, Lars, because, you know, if we are not successful, then Kate, in full candor, can say, look, you guys had 8 months, you know, preparing for this recall, and you couldn't pull it off. So therefore, you know, I guess Oregonians like me, you know, or whatever she says. But, you know, when you have the information czar quitting, you know, because she doesn't want to lie for the governor, and then you have these other things going on with the attorney or counsel, and then what happened to the death penalty, which you're always talking about.
Well, not much after this, because you know what's sad? That the repeal of the death penalty, I think we ought to be honest and say it is effectively a repeal. Technically, it's not, but the circumstances under which the death penalty could be given to anybody are so narrow that they are likely never to happen in my lifetime. So if that isn't a repeal, I don't know what is. But people apparently will watch the governor do this, mistreat foster kids, let kids die in child care, mismanage many state agencies, demand huge. In fact, I think it was as I was driving home, I got in on a late flight Friday night, and I heard one of the news reports, and they said public employees, or maybe it was university employees, have been granted a 5% cost of living increase this year. And I said, 5% this year? Who thinks the cost of living went up 5% this year? No, this ought to be called out for what it is. Unfortunately, the liberals and the Democrats and the government fans have too many friends in newsrooms who will call a 5% increase in pay a cost of living increase to make it sound like, well, we're just keeping up with inflation. Does anybody think inflation is running at 5% right now? Because I can tell you it's not. But
what if you had like 2 or 3,
it's 2%. It's around 2%. It's just in the low twos. It's nowhere near 3. So when you give somebody a 5, that's an actual increase. So if you want to call it for what it is, then call it for what it is. But Mike, if people want to get a hold of you and get in those last signature pages, how do they do it? Because one of the biggest complaints I've heard is people saying, "Where's the address?" And I said, "It's on the form, but you have to look for it." So how do people get those last signature sheets into you?
Well, the mailing address is 4676 Commercial Street, Southeast, Salem, 97302.
Is that on the petition?
It's on the back and it's on the front.
But people have had a tough time finding it. But I know that you're strapped down to what the Secretary of State says you're allowed to put on that. But I want to see people get them in. But at this point, it sounds like neither effort is going to get this on the ballot.
I mean, I wouldn't say that. I've got a couple things that I have left to try. I can't go into specifics about it more than that. We can talk about it after the campaign. But, you know, some funds would be good. We've got about $5,000 in bills to pay off. And then we want to do this at last advertising push, which could push us over the top. And you know, I'm hopeful that it will. But it's going to take more people stepping up and this sort of a thing. Because if we fail, then basically we've written Kate Brown a blank check.
Yep.
You know what I mean?
You sure have.
It's just terrible.
I hate to say it, but Mike, thanks very much. That's Mike Cross, who's running one of two efforts to recall Kate Brown. And based on the numbers he just said, it sounds like neither one is going to make the ballot unless something changes dramatically in the next 2 weeks. Back in just a moment, I want to get to a caller who's curious about that Ukrainian phone call. You know, the famous one made by Donald Trump? We can talk about what the whistleblower lied about in his complaint, and we can talk about what the president actually said in the call, and then we can talk about whether or not the Democrats are willing to throw their own party under the bus to get this president impeached and what it's actually going to accomplish, if anything. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
From the Pacific Office Automation Studios, this is FM News 101 KXL.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, back in our home studios here in the Pacific Northwest after too long inside the Beltway in Washington, D.C. I recommend highly that you go back there and see all of the historic things, maybe even visit with your member of Congress. I got a chance to visit with Pramila Jayapal, who's the member of Congress from the Seattle area, one of them. And we actually had a very nice conversation. We talked about AR-15s. We talked about illegal aliens. We talked about Tom Homan, the former head of ICE, who gave Pramila Jayapal a hard time when he was testifying last week before her committee. She was banging that gavel like crazy, and she asked me if I thought he was right to criticize her. And I said, yeah, occasionally, even members of Congress need to be reminded, you work for us, not the other way around. Too much of government acts as though the people serve the government rather than the government serving the people. But that's a subject for another day. Ken's on the line, listening on the Radio Northwest Network in Springfield. Ken, you wanted to know about the Ukrainian call that the president made back in July. What's up?
Well, I have a little different take on it, Lars. I can't remember what's the name of the outfit that Trump mentioned in the call, along with Biden.
Burisma or CrowdStrike? There are two things. Burisma is the private nat gas company that is thought to be a money laundering operation for a Russian oligarch. That's the one where Joe Biden's boy made a lot of money for sitting on a board of directors of a company that he knew absolutely nothing about. He was not at all qualified for that spot. The other company is called CrowdStrike, which is a company that was used by the Democrats to try to gather election dirt on Donald Trump. And their effort did not work, but it doesn't mean they didn't try.
Well, so correct. So what if there was more on Hillary's computer?
Oh, there was. She admits she erased 30,000 emails.
Right. And so they send it to CrowdStrike. Could it be that that was their final download or their final payoff? The FBI came, asked them, Hillary-friendly FBI, I'll add. But then, no, we're going to send the computer to the Ukraine or wherever.
But I'm not sure what she gets out of that. What would she get out of sending documents that she says she destroyed in violation of federal law, I'm forced to admit? What does she get out of that?
Destruction of the incriminating evidence.
You can destroy it right here. I mean, you know, one of her assistants, you know, took her BlackBerry phone and beat it to death with a ball-peen hammer. So you don't have to send a computer to Ukraine to destroy it.
Right, but that computer, I mean, that could have been the last info, like a dump, an info dump. So they send the computer there not to destroy, well, to eventually destroy it, but to clean it, to purge it, and to retrieve all the information that we don't know that what was on there.
Well, you're getting deeper in conspiracy land than I think. Well, because my question would be, if Hillary believes she kept all that information secret because she didn't want people outside of her circle of friends to know that she was doing pay for play as Secretary of State, that is, she would do certain favors for certain companies like Ericsson Telecom, like some of the companies that did business in Haiti, like signing off on the Uranium One deal so that Rosatom, the Russian company, could buy 20% of America's uranium reserves, and she had to sign off on that deal. But I'm not sure where she would get anything out of sending all that information out of her control to a foreign country. Because if all you want to do is destroy information, you can destroy a hard drive right here. You know, the Ukrainians have no special expertise in destroying hard drives. So I still don't understand why you'd want to send. If I wanted to destroy a hard drive, I'd take my DeWalt drill and drill about 6 holes through the hard drive. And I think that'd pretty well do it. And if I was concerned about that, I guess I'd take the thing and throw it at the bottom of the garbage so it ends up at the bottom of a landfill where nobody can find it and it's still full of holes. So why would she need to send it to Ukraine? I think what they were using Ukraine for was to gather dirt on Donald Trump. It just didn't work, just like the Mueller investigation showed the Steele dossier didn't work. I mean, she and Joe Biden and the rest of these people have been playing the Americans like a fiddle. They've been making hundreds of millions of dollars They've been doing, engaged in all kinds of sleazy activities. And now one of their number, Joe Biden, quid pro quo Joe, as the president calls him, wants to be president.
Something big.
Okay, it's a nice ride.
It's going to happen.
Stand by playback.
And now,
Lars. Real Red Meat Radio.
Should be played at high volume.
This is the Lars Larson Show. Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
And these kids who come, they become Americans before a lot of Americans become Americans.
This is honestly provocative talk.
Your voice is beautiful. I've heard it for a long time.
This is not going to be the country of white people.
Lars.
Don't sit yet. You're going to like this.
Now, here's Lars Larson.
Hell yes. We're going to take your AR-15.
On FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show, and I'm back in the Pacific Northwest after a week in Washington, D.C. for Feet to the Fire and, of course, the inaugural launch of the Democrats Let's All Throw Ourselves Off a Cliff and Pursue Impeachment of Donald Trump and Nancy Pelosi's promise that an impeachment vote will happen before Thanksgiving of this year. I've got a great naysayer coming up on this, I think. Now, I can't always judge naysayers ahead of time, but I want to remind you of something. What is going on here is both a ridiculous promise by Nancy Pelosi to have a vote before Thanksgiving. They have maybe 12 to 14 legislative days between now and Thanksgiving. They don't work a lot. There are actually 28 legislative days between now and the end of this calendar year, if that tells you how much Congress actually works or takes action on legislation. But I think they see two purposes in pursuing impeachment. One is they think they're going to get rid of or damage Donald Trump. I think they're doing exactly the opposite in the polls, and his poll numbers reflect that. Two, I think they see the opportunity to get rid of Joe Biden, because now something that a lot of people did not know about Joe Biden, I knew at least that he had done tremendous favors for his son, Hunter Biden. Of course, Vice President Biden lost a son, but his surviving son, Hunter Biden, is part of an effort to make a lot of money for the Biden family. So I saw this piece, and I want to share this with you before we get to the naysayer. The gist of this is that President Trump simply asked the new president of Ukraine, why is Joe Biden running around our country bragging that he got a prosecutor fired? And what did that have to do with Hunter Biden's position on a natural gas company's board of directors, making literally millions of dollars? And over the weekend, I actually did some research on this because I'd called a friend last week and said, what does somebody get if they're on a really big company's board of directors? Say you're on the board of directors of Nike or Intel or Boeing or Microsoft. Well, you get some pretty fat money. I've never been on a board of directors, but I'm sure it'd be nice. You attend two or three or four board meetings every year, and you get typically about $100,000 for that. So they have to want your skills a lot. In the case of Hunter Biden, Burisma, which is the natural gas company in Ukraine, was paying him $50,000 a month. And in some years, he made even more than that. He made a total of about $3 million over 5 years total that we know of for a board position he had no background in. And I just want to remind you, the biggest companies in America, the most favorable board of director spots in America, pay $250,000 a year. Hunter Biden was getting more than twice that to work on a natural gas company's board of directors, and the natural gas company was located in Ukraine. And you wonder, was the natural gas company really buying the expertise of Hunter Biden, who didn't have any expertise in their particular business, or were they buying some favorable treatment from the man who was then vice president of the United States, and that would be quid pro Joe Biden? So let me go to Alan, who's a naysayer. Alan, we always like to put naysayers first. So what do you and I disagree about today?
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
The biggest thing with this, and I don't know if you've talked about it or anybody else has, but Trump's ego, I guess, if you will, has pretty much jeopardized our relationship in the world from the standpoint him releasing the transcript of that conversation. Pretty much tells most world leaders, do not talk to Trump.
Well,
because we don't know what's going to be put in the media the next day.
Let me push back on that. The reason the transcript was released is that the info was already out there. And the reason we knew the info was out there is that whoever this whistleblower is, he's described as a whistleblower. I don't think he actually meets the definition of whistleblower because he didn't actually know any of this firsthand. But he got the information, some information, about this phone call that happened, and he had put it into a complaint that he filed at the CIA because he was, according to the New York Times, he's a CIA employee. So that compromise of phone calls had already happened. And these other countries, and I share your concern that all these world leaders have to have the ability to talk to each other. And if you think that's unusual, it's actually, imagine this at the company where you work. If you need to walk in and talk to the boss and say, boss, I need to let you know something that's going on here at the company that, you know, may not be a good thing. And the boss says, well, tell me what it is. If you knew that every conversation you had with your boss was immediately going to go on the office teletype and everybody in your office was going to know what you had privately spoken with your boss about. If the boss wants to call, of any company, wants to call somebody in and say, hey, this certain department of the company is not doing a good job and we've decided to shut down that entire section 6 months from now and outsource whatever it is, say the promotion section, we're going to outsource it to another company. Well, you don't want that out early, you know, because you don't want to go and tell the people currently working there, by the way, 6 months from now, you're not going to have a job. We're shutting down this division of the company. The company has a right to hold that information back and let people know when they have to be informed, you know, of you know, 2 weeks notice or whatever it takes in a big factory. Sometimes a company has to give 60 or 90 days notice to its factory workers that they're going to be laid off. But you follow the law, but every single company and every single government agency has to have that kind of privacy. And you're right that if every world leader knows that Donald Trump's phone calls are regularly and routinely intercepted by people and then released for political purposes, the thing is, Alan, do you remember the very first 6 months of the Trump administration? The president, President Trump had a phone call with the president of Mexico. And that phone call was literally out and being publicized by the media within days of him making the phone call. So that damage has already been done, but it's not been done by Trump. He's not the one who leaked the stuff. It's being leaked by people within the government who hate Donald Trump's guts. And they say, when he has a conversation with the president of Mexico and he says, well, I want you to pay for the wall, and the president of Mexico gives a response, they leak it out to damage this president. Frankly, I think they ought to find the people who've done that. They ought to be fired from their jobs. They should never be able to get another public sector job. And if they violated the law, and in many cases they have, they should go to jail. Now, that's my answer for it. But that's not Trump's doing. That is the doing of...
Can I make another point?
Yeah, please.
We're going to extend it. Your career was, part of that was in news reporting and investigating.
That's right.
And typically with something like this, the whistleblower comes out with something, that hit the media, you're right, can't stop that.
Well, you could.
In the past...
You could. If you said this... Well, and by the way, that detail that I gave earlier, and people might have missed it, for decades... Government agencies have had a rule that says you can be a whistleblower on something you have direct knowledge of. So let's say a cop in a police agency says some of my fellow cops are not giving full Miranda warnings to people they take into custody. That'd be a big concern, right?
Yep.
Okay, and he might not be the arresting officer, but if he's a sergeant and he's standing there and he sees an officer taking somebody into custody... And then he listens and he never hears that person being advised of their Miranda rights, it would probably be a good idea for him to go to his lieutenant or his captain or even the chief and say, chief, some of our officers are not giving Miranda warnings and this could torpedo some of our criminal cases. We need to fix this. And his boss can then either say, yeah, we're going to fix it or no, we're not. So that would be direct knowledge. 2 weeks before this complaint was filed, the CIA, for whatever reason, I think to make this possible, because they hate Trump, they changed the rules and said you no longer have to have direct knowledge. And I think the whistleblower's complaint, and this is why I say he's not a whistleblower, he filed a complaint based on information he did not have first knowledge.
All hearsay.
Well, it's not only is it all hearsay, most of the complaint is wrong. What's the center aspect of the complaint? That Donald Trump asked for a quid pro quo, a this for that, from the head of Ukraine. Well, it turns out, based on the transcript, he didn't ask for a quid pro quo, so that's one fault with the complaint, but it's at the very center of the complaint. Number two, he says that the president spent the bulk, to quote from the complaint, the bulk of the phone call talking about Hunter and Joe Biden. Well, you look at the transcript, they talked about a dozen different things, and Hunter and Joe Biden came up exactly once. So the whistleblower didn't even know what he was talking about. He didn't, because he didn't have direct knowledge of it, he just cobbled up a bunch of lies. He said the president pressed the president of Ukraine 8 different times to go after Joe Biden. Well, it turns out, no, he didn't. So the whistleblower's complaint was full of inaccuracies that cut right to the heart of the complaint. It was based not on firsthand knowledge. The basic complaint is the president was asking for a quid pro quo. You help me with my reelection against Joe Biden, and I will give you some things. There was no quid pro quo.
Right. But again, even more reason the president should have said, this is a bunch of malarkey, and in essence, go back to work on other things.
Well, he did, except
every other investigation.
He did.
The media, the
but here's the problem. These days, the media is not going to cut Donald Trump any slack whatsoever. So the first demand from both politicians and the media was, we don't believe that you didn't do this in the call. And the president said, fine, I'll release the transcript of the call. The horse was already out of the barn on my calls are being monitored by my own government and leaked out for political purposes. So this means that where, if you noticed in the transcript, the new president of Ukraine, who, by the way, was a television comic before, and the president were both griping about what a pain in the backside Angela Merkel of Germany is to deal with. Well, can you imagine how that screws up the president's next communication with Angela Merkel? All the more reason for these conversations to be private, because I'm sure Angela Merkel has a few choice things to say about Donald Trump, except her government doesn't seem to leak.
Right.
And so
that's the other side of this coin, too, if I may, is that this Ukrainian president, he's going to be facing this down for the rest of his career, because everybody's going to say, be careful what you tell him, too.
Well, you're right, but that's hard. But that goes back to the first 6 months of the Trump administration in early 2017, when the president talked to the president of Mexico and thought it was a private conversation, and there were jackasses within his own government who apparently hate him so much that they said, let's leak selected parts of a private conversation between two world leaders to damage this president. Now, frankly, I think if there's a way in the law to find those people, because really what they've done is they've damaged their own country. They don't like the election of Donald Trump. You're allowed not to like it. What you're not allowed to do, you know, for instance, you're allowed as a police officer to do your job. But if a new mayor is elected in Seattle, like somebody doesn't like Jenny Durkin, is a cop allowed to use the power that he has by being inside a police agency to deliberately sabotage the administration or the policies of Jenny Durkin? The answer is no. He doesn't have that right. And if he does do it, or she does it, she should be punished, or he should be punished for deliberately using the power of a public servant job to be able to go out and deliberately sabotage your local government. That should be punishable by a trip to jail. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
This is the Lars Larson Show on FM News 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today has to do with a policy that appears to be duplicated in both Oregon and Washington. It has to do with vaping. And here's what they're talking about. In slightly different ways, the state of Oregon and the state of Washington are looking at a ban, a six-month moratorium on the sale of all vaping products. Washington has plans to ban all flavored vaping products, which only means that if Oregon has a six-month moratorium on vaping products, there's going to be a land office business of selling vaping stuff in Vancouver, which people will bring back to Oregon. If they do it in both states, then I think both states will have people who currently vape buying their products online. They'll go to Amazon, and you can buy some of those products on Amazon. or they will find ways to supply themselves otherwise, or they may go back from vaping to cigarettes, which doesn't make any sense either. Today's Twitter poll, at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Glad to be with you. And by the way, the Twitter poll is brought to you by AirPro Guys. If you have any heating or cooling needs, call the AirPro Guys. As premier Lennox dealers, you know you'll be getting the best products and services. Find them online at AirProGuys.com. Now, I want to mention something about rideshare. I don't actually have a dog in the fight on rideshare. I'm in favor of the services existing. But now there seems to be a push, and I'm not in favor of this, by some of the rideshare companies in some Northwest locations. They want to have legislation that would eliminate stringent background checks for drivers. And the Eugene Register Guard points out that for a week, a convicted murderer was working as a driver for one of the rideshare companies in Eugene, Springfield. In another case, a registered sex offender was behind the wheel. In all, according to city statistics, about two dozen drivers for Lyft and Uber were allowed to drive passengers in their personal vehicles for a short time after they cleared the company's third-party background checks, but then failed the local background check that was conducted after they were allowed to work. It was background checks by the Eugene Police Department that ultimately prompted a city regulator to take the four hired drivers off the road. Police discovered the offense while running their own more stringent check and recommended the revocation of the driver's city-issued license. The number of ousted drivers is relatively small given the city has certified 1,800 drivers since Lyft and Uber launched in the marketplace about a year ago. There have been no local reports of an Uber or Lyft driver committing a crime while driving a passenger. Still, the number illustrates the potential public safety risk in the compromises city leaders made to bring ride hailing or ride sharing back into the marketplace. As much as I'm in favor of Uber and Lyft, one of the things I've always believed is that having background checks, and the best ones would be done by the private companies to protect their own business. If Uber or Lyft or both are doing background checks that are so bad that they miss a convicted killer, that they miss a convicted or registered sex offender, then Uber and Lyft need to reconsider where and how they're getting their background checks done. It makes sense for a private company to protect itself. If you have somebody who is hurt or killed or sexually assaulted by somebody you put on the road as an Uber or a Lyft driver without the kind of background check that would actually turn up the interesting things of their background, the indictable things of their background, then Uber and Lyft are going to be in big trouble. On the other hand, I don't necessarily trust government to get it right either. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com.
Miss something on the Lars Larson Show? Check out posted interviews and podcasts at LarsLarson.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Glad to get your phone calls back in our home studio today after a week in the nation's capital last week. And I thought it was very productive, including getting a chance to visit with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal, who represents part of Seattle. Talked to her at the airport. Then she boarded a flight for Seattle. I boarded a flight for Portland. On the flight to Portland, the three of the Democrats who are on the congressional delegation for the state of Oregon were sitting up in first class. The rest of us regular citizens were sitting back in coach. And I thought, aren't you glad you pay your federal taxes to make sure that Earl Blumenauer and Peter DeFazio and Suzanne Bonamici can fly in luxury in the front of the airplane? So you got that as well. I brought up the subject of background checks for people who drive Uber and Lyft. And I got an interesting feedback or piece of feedback from somebody in the cab industry. And they say that they have always argued there ought to be tough background checks. Here's the interesting detail that Radio Cab puts out. They say they have repeatedly argued to the city and the Oregon legislature for fingerprint background checks and that PBOT must be the agency responsible. Currently, Uber, Lyft, and my taxi company may choose to do their own internal background check, and then PBOT has 30 days to audit and confirm that the driver qualifies. That is, they don't have a criminal background. PBOT apparently does not run a city background check. They just double check what has been done by the company that is self-certifying. Uber and Lyft have chosen to do their own background checks, and they're putting drivers to work that have no business driving the public. The city has its own issues keeping up with audits, and at peak times, they may be running 2 to 3 weeks behind the 30-day requirement set out in the code. That means there are drivers active now that should not be. Now, how much do you think that's happening, not just in Portland, but in other cities, that set out a bunch of regulations and say you have to meet the regulations to operate these vehicles on the street and pick up and drop off customers, and then the cities themselves don't hold up to their own set of requirements? If the city says, give us 30 days to double check the background check, and all they do is look at the process done by Uber and Lyft, I'd agree with Radio Cab. That's certainly not enough. And if they're not doing their own background check, given that every single city in the Northwest has access to be able to do background checks that I assume would go through the LEDS, the Law Enforcement Data System, or even the NICS system, if you could use one of those systems to make sure somebody is not mentally ill, somebody does not have a criminal record, somebody is not a registered sex offender, somebody is not a convicted killer. Turns out that the Eugene Register Guard has found that in Eugene, they had for some weeks a convicted murderer driving an Uber or Lyft car. They had a registered sex offender driving an Uber or a Lyft car. Now, you can imagine the potential hazards there. Why have the requirements if the cities that make the requirements themselves do not hold to the rules? Let's go to Ray in Aberdeen, Washington, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, Ray, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.
So my question is, the Trump call to the president in the Ukraine was back in July.
Yep.
Then in August, the CIA changed the rules on whistleblowers that they didn't no longer had to have direct information of the complaint.
Correct.
Which flashes Brenner and Clapper in my head. And then now all of a sudden, the complaint comes forward in September, and the Democrats are taking it and running with it. But my concern or my question is, how come all of a sudden now the whistleblower doesn't have to have direct knowledge?
I would say I doubt the CIA has a good reason for that. It almost, I mean, to me, it has the appearance that people within the intelligence community who don't particularly like Donald Trump and have decided to take him down, that they said, well, we don't have the information to be able to file a complaint from direct knowledge, so let's just change the rules so that we don't have to have that. Because you understand, in some ways, they managed to get a process started of asking questions saying, we think Donald Trump has done something illicit. Based on what? Based on a complaint. Well, as I pointed out, the complaint itself, with the release of the transcript, the complaint is fraudulent. It is about as good, Ray, and there are times... if somebody ever faults me on this, I'll be glad to admit it's true. There are times I get on the radio and I say, I'm hearing from sources that X, Y, and Z are true. But I always tell you, I'm hearing this from sources. And then oftentimes I'll tell you, this is a source who's almost always been solid, or this is a source that's sketchy. I try to give you some characterization of whether or not the information is to be believed or not. There are other times I will entirely spitball. I'll say, this agency did A on Monday, this agency did B on Wednesday, and this agency did C on Thursday or Friday. I think it adds up to this. But I admit to you that it's just speculation on my part. And usually I try to imagine other reasons those three things might have happened that don't add up to what I think they're going to add up to. Just like I just told you that, why did the CIA change the rules strangely at this incredibly convenient time to allow a complaint to be filed? I think the explanation might be that there are people in the intelligence community who've been trying to take down the president. And if you were to ask me, well, Lars, why do you suspect that? I'd say, well, since the beginning of the Trump administration, every presidential administration leaks to some extent. They all do. Sometimes they even leak deliberately. They will send out a trial balloon to see what the public reaction is. But there are other times where the leak is so damaging to the administration that you know it didn't come from the administration. It came from somebody within, you know, either in Congress or in the staff who doesn't like this president or thinks this president is doing things wrong. So they say, I'm going to leak some information. I'll call up a reporter friend of mine, and I'll get the information out. Much as former and fired FBI head James Comey thought, I want this information about my conversation with the president, which was classified, out. So I will give it to a university professor friend of mine and tell him to take it to some friends of the New York Times. So he has a cutout, the same kind of cutout that Hillary Clinton and the DNC used by going through Perkins Coie, the Seattle law firm, to pay all that money to Fusion GPS. Why? So that you'd have some ability to say, well, we didn't pay that money. We didn't hire Fusion GPS. They were hired by the Seattle law firm. You know, that's what criminals and people engaged in illicit activities do. They use other methods to pay for things so that the money can't be traced back to them. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, right? Nobody goes out and buys, right, you know, illegal drugs with a personal check. They usually don't use a credit card or a debit card either. They pay in cash. Why? Because it's easier to say it wasn't my cash. You know, I wasn't involved in that transaction. I suspect that the CIA changed the rules deliberately to go after Trump. And I'd say the proof that the intelligence agencies have been out to get Trump is that they have tens of thousands of employees. Some of those employees hate this president with a passion, and they've decided that while they're working on a paycheck paid from my taxes and your taxes, they're going to use the power they have in their office to go after this guy, right? And they can do it by simply letting information out. For instance, let's say in a really corrupt city, you have a police agency that knows a lot of things that turn into a criminal indictment, some things that don't. You do an investigation. So you say, we don't like this guy over here. We don't like Ray from Aberdeen. So Ray's trying to buy a house, or he's trying to buy a business. Let's let the word get to his bankers and his investors that at one point his name came up in a criminal investigation, and it'll kill the deal. And you say, but the criminal investigation never showed that Ray from Aberdeen did anything wrong. You say, yeah, but it won't matter to the investors or the bank. They will want to avoid trouble. So they will say, gosh, you know, we've heard, and they probably won't even tell you. So all of a sudden you have a call from your banker saying, Ray, we tried to put that financing together and it's just not going to happen. And unless you dig real hard to find out who got a phone call from the Aberdeen police saying, you know, Ray's name came up in an investigation of drugs or, you know, sex trafficking or something. But they're not going to tell you that because the bank doesn't want to get sued by you either. So you could imagine how people within a government agency might be able to do great damage to somebody, to a political figure like President Trump, to an individual citizen. And is it legal and ethical to do that? Of course not. But have they been doing it to this president? I think they've been doing it to him since day one. I cited the example of the phone call to the president of Mexico, and all of a sudden, all the information from that phone call was public, was published within days of the president having that call. Now, that's outrageous that the president of our country might try to have a private conversation with the head of another country, and he ends up with the information being made public. And you say, where'd that come from? Well, I would like to suggest that the intelligence agencies, starting with the CIA, would be the best source for that information, wouldn't it?
I would think so.
I would think so. I mean, it could be the FBI. It could even be other government agencies that for some reason have access to that info. But if you are working on the public's payroll and you decide to deliberately sabotage a president because your fellow Americans elected him instead of somebody else, that is not your job as a government employee. As a private citizen, you can do whatever you want to do. But as a government employee, you often have access to all kinds of information that you only have access to do your job. If you then decide to use that information to advance your own personal political agenda, you ought to be fired. And as far as I'm concerned, you ought to be thrown in jail. Back in just a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. Glad to get your phone calls and emails. Vote in our Twitter poll, which you can find online at Lars Larson Show and LarsLarson.com. Will this new policy push vapors to cigarettes? Oregon and apparently Washington right behind them pushing the idea of banning certain kinds of vaping for 6 months. Well, listen, I got to tell you something. You ever been around somebody who smokes cigarettes and is addicted and has run out of cigarettes for even a few hours or a day or two? Yeah, it's not a good thing. So can you imagine when the governor says you should all just stop vaping? The only alternative is going to be buying cigarettes. If the governor of Oregon says we're going to ban the sale of vaping products, an awful lot of those people are not going to be able to quit cold turkey. So they will simply obtain the products elsewhere. And they'll establish a new permanent supply, and then you'll have nothing to say about it at all. Or they will switch from vaping to cigarettes, which are demonstrably more dangerous. Let's go to Jack. Hey, Jack, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Yeah, hi, Lars. Thanks for taking my call.
I'm calling
about the Kate Brown petition.
Yeah.
A month ago, my wife and I were spending the night in Summer Lake, and we went in to have dinner, and I noticed two petitions there.
Yeah.
And that's the first time I'd heard about two petitions for the recall.
We've been talking about it for months. That's okay, but it's just everybody is now telling me, this is the first I've heard about it. Well, the recall campaign has been going on for 2.5 months.
Yeah, well, I signed it when it first came out, my wife and I did.
All right.
And then we come to find out there's two of them going on.
Yep.
And in my opinion, I don't know who your guest was earlier, if he started the first one.
That was Mike Cross. He started one of the two. They both effectively started at the same time. But what's your suggestion? Because we're kind of late in the game for all of these. It sounds like neither one of these is going to be successful, which at the beginning I said, to recall any public official, you need a huge level of actual anger. I mean, gut level anger at somebody to do a recall. And I didn't sense that it was there. And it sounds like that's what we're seeing. We're going to see a couple 100,000 signatures and likely not enough to put it on the ballot, which means it's almost worse than if you hadn't done it at all. Because Kate Brown and her people are going to point at that and say, see, nobody wants to recall the governor.
Well, in my opinion, whoever started one of them, why couldn't they have joined forces?
That we have talked and talked and talked about over the last couple of months. And the answer is they could have, except that both of the organizations thought that they were doing it the right way, which is the same way as Brexit. In the beginning, I think there were four groups in Great Britain that were identified as wanting to exit, you know, the European Union. And in the end, they were forced by the British system to choose one of the groups to be the lead group. And they did that. But we're way past that point, aren't we?
And now it sounds like it now.
Well, woulda, coulda, shoulda. Everybody knew the risks at the time. But thank you for the call. Let's go to Billy. Hey, Billy, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. And thanks for the call from Gig Harbor.
Hi, first time caller.
Thank you.
I'm just on this thing about the whistleblower.
Yeah.
I really believe this started out as a typical CIA leak, but they couldn't sell it to anybody to get it out there because the media maybe is finally learning that they're the ones that are set with egg on their face. So they had to go back to the drawing board and change the rules for whistleblower because now they've got a dramatic whistleblower.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right.
Stuck with it again.
Because, remember, people are now giving a lot of credence to the whistleblower, even though we know from the transcript that almost everything the whistleblower, so-called, had to say in his complaint, and it turns out it sounds like it is a male who works for the CIA, according to the New York Times, was inaccurate. It didn't at all reflect what happened in that half-hour phone call. But it doesn't matter because they got the ball rolling.
Of course.
Now, but you know what's great about it, Billy? They got the ball rolling, but now it's like Indiana Jones. That big old ball looks like it's going to roll right over the Democrat Party. They're like Harrison Ford running away from that big old stone ball that's rolling down right at them, and they don't know where they can go at this point. But they sure know it's going to roll over Joe Biden first. You got the Lars Larson Show.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
You're ready.
Exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
On the Lars Larson Show, which is, you know, he's a conservative talk radio host.
Broadcasting from Portland to Seattle and all of Oregon and Washington.
It's loud, it's strong, and it's good, and I appreciate your support.
This is Honestly Provocative Talk with Lars Larson.
The world is going to end in 12 years if we don't address climate change.
Lars, if you have evidence of wrongdoing by any member of the Trump campaign, present it to the damn grand jury.
Here's Lars Larson.
Hell yes, we're going to take your AR-15.
On FM News. 101.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you back in our home studio after a little trip last week to Washington, D.C. for Feet to the Fire. Little did we know that it was going to be the beginning of impeachment week, as the Democrats have done a political calculation. They have calculated that a regular leak from the CIA was not going to do the trick. So the CIA changed the rules and said, why, sure, you can have whistleblower complaints based on information that you don't actually know yourself. So a so-called whistleblower cobbled up a complaint. We now know, based on the transcript released from that White House call between the president of the United States and the president, the new president of Ukraine, that the whistleblower got it completely wrong on all the essential elements. But the Democrats have forged ahead with Nancy Pelosi by week's end promising a vote on impeachment by Thanksgiving. I'm glad they've thrown down this kind of deadline, because now when they slip the deadline and say, well, maybe it's by Hanukkah or it could be by Christmas, it might be before Valentine's Day, that every time they slip, I know the mainstream media will make excuses for them, but we will not. We will say, why didn't you get this done? And I think they have a dual purpose here. They want to see how much pain they can inflict on the president of the United States, because they have never accepted the results of the 2016 election. And they see the opportunity to take old quid pro quo Joe Biden and throw him under the bus so they can get a really radical lunatic candidate like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders or maybe even Mayor Pete, somebody other than Joe Biden. On that note, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program again Adam Kennedy, Deputy Assistant to President Trump and Deputy Director of Communications. Adam, good to have you back on the program.
Thanks so much for having me out again, Lars.
So, you know, over the weekend, I saw all these reports from the, you know, the fake stream media saying, well, the White House is in terminal panic. They're panicked that the president is being talked about for impeachment by Nancy Pelosi, and she promises a vote before Turkey Day. And I don't think that's going to happen. But what is actually happening at the White House right now? And how is the president going to react to this call for his impeachment?
Well, we're still working for the American people. We're still pushing policies to help everybody in this country. And what's really sad to see is that the Democrats have decided to go all in on politics, all in on partisanship, and trying to undermine this administration instead of working with us on important matters like USMCA or drug pricing or anything else that we have on the docket that they have refused to pick up. But the facts are that we've known since even before the president's inauguration, that there has been a part of the Democratic Party, a growing part, that doesn't believe this president's legitimate and is going to do everything possible to undermine him. So are we panicking? Absolutely not. We are going to continue to work for the American people, and we're going to continue to push back against these false allegations.
Adam, what I truly don't understand, most of the time I think I have a pretty good idea of why things happen involving one side or the other, but what I really don't understand, and I'll admit I'm biased toward President Trump, but I don't understand where the Democrats are going with this, because I've looked at the numbers. Nancy Pelosi, if she can get, you know, almost every single Democrat in the House to vote for impeachment, they might be able to pull off impeachment. But it's then going to go to the Senate, and they need almost 20 Republicans to join them in voting to convict the president and remove him. Otherwise, he just goes into the same status as Bill Clinton, as a living American president who's been impeached. And nothing else happens as a result of that. And I imagine that a lot of the Democrats who sit in seats that aren't, you know, 60% or 70% blue are going to probably lose their seats. And she was asked about that this weekend. She was asked, well, don't you stand to lose the House of Representatives? And she said, it doesn't matter. So are they just hoping for some kind of Pyrrhic victory where they win by burning down the House?
I don't think they actually expect this to go through to impeachment. I think they see it as a losing issue if it does get to the Senate, and they'd be right, I think. But at the end of the day, this isn't about finding the truth. This isn't about the facts. The president's released the transcript. Anybody can read. Anybody in the whole world, anybody in this country can read this call and see if it reaches a level of impeachment or not. And I think anybody with any kind of rationality and a sense of proportion about him would say that there's nothing wrong here and nothing inappropriate. What they're trying to do is turn this, what is a regular phone call with a foreign leader, into essentially a political prop for them as they go into 2020. And it's really a shame because we still have a lot of time left before the campaign season really heats up for us to make a lot of gains for the American people.
Well, Adam, like you said, if you've read the transcript, I read the entire transcript, I read the entire complaint, then I went back and read the transcript again, and then I went back and read the complaint again. And I have some nuts and bolts questions. Why did the CIA change the rules to say, after apparently decades of a rule being in place, that now you can be a whistleblower, so-called, even though you have no direct knowledge of the thing you're supposedly blowing the whistle on?
You know, that's really a question for the CIA. I don't know.
Yeah, well, they don't have directors of communication that talk that much to the press.
They're not returning your callers?
Yeah, exactly. They call them up and say, well, we could tell you, but then we'd have to kill you. And I decided I'd rather not die. So, but I mean, doesn't it seem as the church lady, well, this is before your time, but on Saturday Night Live, they used to have the church lady.
Oh, of course.
And isn't it convenient that they changed the rules and 2 weeks later, this whistleblower who heard it from a friend who heard it from a friend, you were messing around, to quote REO Speedwagon, comes out with a complaint that he doesn't have any direct knowledge of, and it shows when you compare the complaint to the transcript, because they don't match up.
Well, what's even more shocking is that there's, at this point, now that the transcript's released, there's nothing in that complaint that is in public knowledge. Half the complaint is a transcript. The other half is just news reports that anybody could look up. The only thing tying this together into a complaint is this person's, I guess you would call it, conspiracy theory against the president. But it's a pretty weak theory at that. And it shows, I think, kind of the level of polarization that has happened, that something like this is even being taken seriously. You know, the DOJ actually looked at this complaint, career officials, and they found that there was nothing to it when it comes to election interference or anything improper for the 2020 election. But that's exactly what the president's being accused of. So I'm sorry, but they can't have it both ways. They can't say this whistleblower who's a career official is completely trustworthy. We have to believe everything he says. But these other career officials who cleared the president on exactly what we're accusing of, they're not believable at all.
So tell me this. I really want to know whether or not Joe Biden, as vice president, broke the law by pursuing the firing of a prosecutor who is looking into an obscure, well, at least obscure for Americans, natural gas company in Ukraine, with the only distinguishing feature being that his son had managed to make millions of dollars as a board member of Burisma, the nat gas company, that apparently is a money laundering operation, perhaps, for a Russian oligarch. Other than that, why would Joe Biden give a damn whether the prosecutor looked at Burisma or not, except for the fact that his son would be implicated? And then perhaps the thing that Burisma was actually buying, which was Joe Biden's good favor, because that's the only thing I could see they were buying. Hunter Biden doesn't seem to know anything. He has a law degree, but he doesn't seem to know anything about Ukraine, doesn't seem to know anything about energy or natural gas. So why are they paying this guy an amount of money as a board of directors member that absolutely eclipses major companies? I checked over the weekend, Adam, and I told my audience, a typical big company pays an American board of directors member $100,000 a year, about $25,000 a meeting, to go to four board meetings and vote on important stuff. For the biggest of American companies, they pay $250,000 a year, $60,000 a meeting. And this company was paying this guy over $600,000 a year to sit on a board of a company that he knew nothing about.
Well, you know, it's a good gig if your dad's the vice president of the United States, I guess.
I would love to have a gig like that, Adam, wouldn't you? I'm going to go sit on a board. I know nothing about the company. I'll be glad to vote on everything and eat the free pastries and take the trip to wherever the board meeting is, and you can give me $50,000 to go to a board meeting. It's a great gig, but it stinks of political corruption, doesn't it?
And this is exactly the type of swampy behavior the president ran against and that he continues to try and fight here in D.C., where purely because of your last name or who your father is, the door is open to you, while average Americans were forced to struggle under the previous administration. You know, while we were having one of the sluggish recoveries with low wage growth, low employment growth under the previous administration. The son of the vice president was getting a sweetheart deal with the Ukrainian natural gas company, and everybody's supposed to act like that's completely normal. And then we're supposed to act like it's completely normal when the vice president says to another country, if you don't fire this guy who's looking into my son's company, we're going to have some serious problems. I mean, it does not get more swampy, more inside D.C. than that right there.
Absolutely. Adam, it is a pleasure to always to have you on the phone. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
That is Adam Kennedy, who is Deputy Assistant to President Trump and Deputy Director of Communications. We'll be back in a moment. We'll get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com.
First-time callers and naysayers always go first. This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and your emails. I want to mention something. 40 years ago this year was the year that I worked in Spokane, Washington. And it's a great town. It's a very, really wonderful town with a lot of great people in it. And I enjoyed living there. I was there a year. But one of the things they told me, I still remember this, when I arrived, because I arrived in March, and they said, listen, it's cold now, and this fall, about Halloween, the temperature will drop below freezing, and it will not come above freezing, this was 1979, until, March or April of next year. And they said that it happens that way every year. Well, things change. These are the normal cycles of weather, not necessarily climate. And now it's getting cold up there. In fact, imagine this. In Spokane, they have now received almost 2 inches of snow on Saturday, which made it the snowiest September day in the city's history and the first measurable September snow in 93 years. So we're going back into that cycle where you have snow almost every year in Spokane and places like that. So that's just weather. And as I've had Chuck Weiss, our friend, the meteorologist, point out, weather cycles are sometimes long enough that people forget about them. Because if it snowed almost every year when you were 10 years old, and you just remember it as being snowy there, like I do from Klamath Falls, when it was snowy every single year in the wintertime. And then it goes for 35 years through a cycle where it gets warmer. You don't have as much of a certain kind of weather. And then, 35 years or so or 40 years later, it cycles back. How likely are you to have an accurate recollection? And in fact, in a very mobile population like the United States, how likely are you to still live in the place where you lived when it snowed every fall or it didn't snow every fall? In any case, the snowiest September day in 93 years, and the first measurable September snow in 93 years, and the snowiest day in September in the city's entire history, going back as long as they've been keeping records. Do your calls now at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Let me go to Victoria. Hey, Victoria, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hi, good afternoon. I talked to Bryce a little bit, and I know this is a change of subject. I've been trying to get some protocols from the Lake Oswego Police Department, and they say they don't have any.
Well, what protocol? So what do you want to find out?
What their protocols are for suicide calls.
For suicide calls, like when somebody calls and says, I'm planning to do myself in.
When they get a call that says somebody's planning to do themselves in.
Oh, when somebody else calls and says, I think a person may be planning to commit suicide.
Right. So then there's four things, right? What do you do if somebody says that? And then what do you do if you go there and they say, well, that's a mistake. What do you do if they go and say yes? And then what do you do if they're dead? Right?
Well, I know what they do if they're dead. They have an investigation to determine whether the person died as a result of foul play or as a result of their own hand. And I think that determination isn't made by the cops. It's made by the medical examiner. I think when dispatch, whether it's no matter what city it's in, when dispatch gets a call from somebody who is suicidal, I think they right. It probably differs from case to case to case. Because if you're calling saying, I think someone that I'm not with right now. I assume you're not talking about a situation where somebody says, hi, I'm the mother, and I think my 16-year-old son is in his bedroom and he's about to commit suicide. You're talking about somebody who's not physically with the person who may try, right?
Correct.
Okay, so when you call and say, I think somebody might be planning to commit suicide, they may send an officer by for a welfare check, but I'll bet they do it on a case-by-case basis based on what information they're given. And isn't that going to change in each and every case? Why don't you tell me why you're curious? It sounds like you have a personal situation, you know, where this has happened. Then why don't you tell me what it is so that everybody listening can understand why you're curious?
Yeah, and thank you for changing the subject because I know...
I'm not changing the subject. You ask about suicide protocols. I'm wondering why you're calling about suicide protocols.
Right. No, I know you're talking about the whistleblower. So it was back in May, and we made a call to Suicide Hotline about the medical profile in the United States about suicide. In other countries...
So you weren't calling about a specific case. You were just calling about suicide generically?
Yeah. So then I got a text at about... I'm going to talk to the Suicide Hotline. And I got a text at about 6 o'clock, and I thought it was some joke. It said, hi, this is Officer something. You're not in trouble. I just need to know you're okay. And I thought that was some joke, and I didn't answer.
Well, why would you not see that as connected to your call? I mean, if I call dispatch and say, hi, what do you know about the likelihood of suicide? And you don't explain.
I didn't call dispatch.
Who'd you call?
I called the National Suicide Hotline.
And they probably work with local police agencies, because if you call the National Suicide Hotline, they're thinking either, A, you're somebody about to commit suicide, or somebody who knows a person like that, and they want the local police to call and check on you, a welfare check. Right?
Okay.
And then when somebody asks, are you okay, having just called on suicide, you decide not to tell them you're okay?
No, that call was about 2 o'clock that I made.
Yeah.
That email, that text was about 6:30.
Okay, so a few hours later, I'm working against the clock.
Let me go forward.
Tell me what happened.
At about 11:30, here's all these cops at my door.
Yeah, because they think that you're somebody who may have taken her own life. Doesn't it add up to you that way?
Yes.
It adds up to me that way as well. You call, you ask about suicide generically, they call your local police agency, they send you a text, you don't reply, they think you may have taken your own life, and then the cops show up. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on FM News 101.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. People sometimes ask me, is your show about politics? And I say, well, it is about politics in the sense that almost everything in America now is politics. Vaping is political. Cigarettes are political. Suicide's political. Healthcare is political. Your food is political. The president's phone calls to the president of Ukraine are political. Everything's political these days. So I thought it'd be interesting to talk to Kyle Mills, who's the best-selling author of more than 20 books. His latest installment in a series of books I like, the Mitch Rapp series, Lethal Agent, joins me on the phone now to talk about some of the current political battlefield and how it inspired you. Hey, Kyle, welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me again.
So you imagine a toxic presidential election is underway in America, already badly weakened by internal divisions. And while the politicians are all wound up in their own problems and trying to maintain their own power and privilege, ISIS kidnaps somebody who knows how to make basically biological warfare. Is that pretty well sum it up?
That pretty much covers it, yeah.
And you have to have been drawing from the current political environment. Do you think anybody on Capitol Hill is paying attention to most anything about the real problems of this country and this world, or are they all focused on the impeachment and a phone call that happened 2 months ago?
Oh, and other things. I mean, it's kind of incredible. Nobody even talks about the problems anymore or security. It seems like every time a conversation like that comes up, it then turns immediately into which political party can take advantage of it and, you know, get elected.
It's kind of a sad environment, isn't it? Because I would hope that people who call themselves public servants would say, we've got some problems, and we're actually very fortunate as a country. I think America's very blessed to have all the abundance that it has, and we certainly compare well with almost any... Well, I can't think of another place on planet Earth that I'd really like to live better than the United States of America. But in the middle of all that, because we have so much abundance around us, it allows us to get all wound up about a lot of things that... you know, aren't necessarily about the practical problems of what's going on in the world.
Yeah, it's a real shame because, you know, if you take this for granted, you know, that description won't hold. We won't always be the best country in the world. You have to keep paying attention, and to allow, you know, our entire leadership to become obsessed with, you know, getting reelected as opposed to fixing the problems and dealing with the things that America needs is ridiculous.
So I want you to talk a little bit about your background, though, because I don't think we've talked about that before, about the kind of stories you used to hear as a kid because of your dad's rather unique job. What did he do at the time?
Yeah, he was an FBI agent for many years, actually in Salem, and later became the director of Interpol and the legal attaché to the United Kingdom. So I kind of grew up around, you know, spec ops people and FBI, CIA, MI5, MI6. That was those were always the family friends.
So if you ask your dad to tell you stories, he didn't have to tell you that he'd tell them to you, but he'd have to kill you if he told you the story. You could actually hear some parts of them.
Yeah, some parts of them were okay. Other parts you didn't hear anything about. But kind of an interesting way to grow up, because these people were always so larger than life. And, you know, you can imagine being a young boy hearing all these stories. It was pretty incredible.
Well, no kidding to hear about, you know, the dad is somehow involved. And I don't know, I mean, how much was he involved in field work versus, say, running the operation as head of Interpol? I don't know whether that actually requires you to go out and put on a trench coat and talk to people in dark alleys, or are you just running the people who'd actually do that?
Well, at first, he was very much involved in that when he was a street agent in Oregon. I mean, he's been attacked by monkeys, thrown out of second-story windows. I mean, he has kind of a storied career. And then when he went to London, you know, that was more of an executive position. But actually, he was there when Pan Am 103 went down, and he ended up running that investigation.
Oh, my God. People who don't remember that reference is the jetliner that was blown up by a bomb on board it from who else? Muslim jihadis who blow up a bomb in an aircraft full of people that comes falling out of the sky over Scotland or Ireland.
Yeah, Scotland. Little town in Scotland called Lockerbie.
And people came to know the name Lockerbie and thought about the horror of having a jetliner just explode in midair and rain bodies and luggage and airplane parts down over the countryside. It's a very terrible, terrible situation.
Oh, yeah, it was incredibly horrible. And interestingly, a piece of shared history I have with the Mitch Rapp character, because he joined the CIA because his girlfriend was on that flight. So kind of interesting that happened. That actually happened at my graduation dinner from college. We were having dinner, and my father's assistant came in and said, you know, plane's gone down over Scotland. We think it might be terrorism. And that was the last I saw of my father for a few months.
Wow. I mean, and then when he comes back, I mean, how much could he actually sit down and share with you? Because if you were college age at that point, he probably knew there are some things I can share, but even as the rules still apply that applied when you were a little kid, that you can't tell your son everything that's going on.
Well, certainly not the investigative stuff, but the situation there on the ground was really horrible because, like you said, it just rained down stuff everywhere. And I remember him telling me that, you know, there was a woman who kept calling and saying, you know, there was a young couple sitting in their airplane seats in her backyard. And she really wanted somebody to come and get him, but he didn't have the manpower at that point and just said, you're going to have to close your drapes and we're going to get there as soon as we can.
Well, and as you write these books about Mitch Rapp and a fictional character, and the latest one is called Lethal Agent, we've come so far from there to here with more perhaps knowledge and sense that these kind of attacks can attack the American homeland as well as the rest of the world. But the bad guys have incredible tools as well that they didn't have when you began writing this series?
Yeah, it's kind of a fascinating idea that's followed me throughout my career, the idea that as technology grows, you know, an individual can have great power. And with a bioweapon, that's very, very true. You read a lot about these elaborate setups where somebody genetically engineers some virus and then they, you know, drop it out of planes and all that stuff. But it's not really necessary. Viruses and diseases crop up around the world, and you could literally just get a bunch of people sick and bring them into the United States and have them spread it around. You know, it doesn't take much. And then if you look back at the history of these diseases, like the Spanish flu or the plague, you could be talking about wiping out 1 billion people.
Well, you know, what I've always thought about, Kyle, is the fact that people have to remind themselves that the most serious, the largest terrorist attack against American soil, 9/11, happened involving people buying an ordinary airline ticket and a box cutter knife and just walking on the plane. You know, that it was very, in some ways, it was very, very low tech. And that I'm like you. I fear more the low tech approach than the person who has the secret lab somewhere, you know, and the elaborate setup. That's not as likely as the person or the group that simply says, we can easily do this. We'll go harvest Ebola somewhere, get a bunch of people sick and put them on airplanes when they still look well, knowing that they'll arrive and create terrible destruction when they do.
Yeah, and it really, you know, you think about the aftermath of that. I mean, if you look back in history, the stories of the plague where, you know, people were out drinking in the street and they ran out of chairs. They just walk into a house and get one because they figured nobody lived there anymore. Everybody was dead. So, I mean, it really is incredible the impact disease has on the world. I mean, much more so than really anything else that humans have experienced. So that kind of thing really does keep me awake at night.
No doubt. And as well it should. And I wish we were more focused on that than you know, what the president said about quid pro quo. I want to use the phrase that the president came up with, quid pro quo Joe Biden and his son. Then I wish they were more focused on the real threats against this country than whether or not somebody made a phone call. But that's where politics gets into it. His latest book is called Lethal Agent. He is Kyle Mills. Kyle, it's good to have you back on the program.
Thanks for having me.
You betcha. Glad to have you on. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on a Monday and glad to be with you on the Radio Northwest Network. Yes, we spent a week in our nation's capital and came away from it not with that inside the beltway disease that so many people seem to get when they spend too much time back there. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. It should be interesting to find out from the Oregon GOP whether or not they are in any better shape on the recall of Kate Brown than the other organization is, the Flush Down Kate Brown. There are two simultaneous recalls going on. Each of them could make the ballot. One of them, we heard today, the Flush Down Kate Brown, is at 200,000 signatures. They need 280,000 within the next 14 days, or it will not make the ballot. I'm hoping that the GOP, the state GOP, is in better shape to get that one on the ballot. I'd like to see a vote for whether or not they think the failed leadership, I consider it the failed leadership of Kate Brown, is worthy of staying or worthy of removal. Frankly, I think that she has done a terrible job on human services. She's done a terrible job by raising taxes dramatically. She has not tackled the biggest problems like the PERS system that is $50 billion in the red. She hasn't tackled some of the biggest problems of the state, but she has tackled a lot of the little ones that benefit her friends in the unions. And that's about all she's done. Let's go to Isaac. Hey, Isaac, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Hey, thanks for having me, Lars. Calling about the vaping thing going on down here in Oregon.
Yeah.
Of course, it's already been banned in Washington.
Well, the Fruity Pebbles flavors have been banned in Washington. They've banned the flavored stuff, but not the others. Oregon's talking about a ban on all of it.
That's a very good point. What I do know as a retail tobacconist, we have some vapor customers
most of them never saw this coming. And a lot of those that I spoke to this last weekend said they'll go back to smoking. So that's definitely going to happen if Kate Brown comes down with her band hammer.
So you think my theory, because I kept thinking this through, Isaac, and as somebody who doesn't smoke and doesn't vape, I'm looking at it from just an outsider's point of view. But the governor is now talking about a six-month moratorium on the sale of all vaping products. And I thought, do they really think people can just cold turkey this and say, oh, the governor told me to stop vaping, so I'll stop? I don't think that's going to happen. I don't think making them, you know, not available in the state anymore is going to stop them, because people will buy online, or they'll find a way to supply themselves from products outside the state. And the nearest alternative right now is Washington State, unless Washington State decides to follow suit. So all you're going to do is force people who vape to buy on the other side of the Columbia River. And if Washington were to follow and say, okay, we'll both have a six-month moratorium, that almost seems like a way to torture a large percentage of your population by saying you're addicted to something. We know you can't quit cold turkey or on short notice, so we're going to cut you off from this stuff altogether. And the most obvious go-to, what an economist would call substitute good, would be a carton of cigarettes. And it sounds, and you know, if you really want a great conspiracy theory, try this one, Isaac. The state of Oregon makes no money on the sale of cigarettes. State of Washington makes a little because they have sales tax, but they don't have any tobacco tax. There's no equivalent tobacco tax on vaping. So the state of Oregon makes money. It's been seeing the money it makes go down as people switch from cigarettes to the safer and more healthy, not entirely healthy, but more healthy than smoking. They've been seeing people switch to vaping. So now they're going to force them to go back from vaping to smoking cigarettes, and the state of Oregon makes money on it.
Exactly, and it gives the state of Oregon another 6 months to say, hey, let's figure out how we're going to tax vaping.
And how would they do that after all? I mean, how in the world would they apply a tax to vaping? Because I assume that once you bought the device, would they tax the fluid?
Exactly, and they've done it in other states where they tax the fluid by the milliliter quantity of fluid. And in Oregon, they've proposed it here and there where it would have the same OTP tax as other tobacco products and be taxed at 65% of wholesale costs.
Except,
so again, that'll drive people elsewhere.
Well, and here's the thing. They usually predicate the taxes on tobacco these days. I mean, back in the day, the government just said, we're going to put a sin tax on. But now they always say, we're putting a tax on this because it's bad for you. So anything bad for you has a tax on it. Booze has a tax on it. Cigarettes have a tax on it. But in the case of vaping, there's the vapor products. And again, as a non-vapor, non-cigarette smoker, vapor products are about 95% less damaging to you than cigarette. So should they be taxed at the same level if the powers that be, you know, the governors and the legislatures are saying, we're taxing this to make the money up to pay for the health damage you're doing to yourself? Well, if the health damage is dramatically lower, should they charge a tax that's say, 5% of what the tax is that they charge on cigarettes? I know that the people who love taxes in Salem and Olympia are not going to go for that deal. They say, we want to make big piles of money on people smoking something that's bad for them. So I don't even know how they're going to justify that. But with taxes, Democrats don't have to justify it. They just have to tax. You got the Lars Larson Show.